Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for Maze Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much there. And we're going to have a little look at critical care of birds today. And I think it's very important that when we're seeing birds coming through as patients, that they do have quite a high metabolic rate. Most of them are obviously prey species as well, and so they are very good at hiding illness until they actually become quite critically ill. And if we take a look at, say, for example, a small citizen like this budgie, for example, we have to think about how I guess owners think when they're looking at their pets. And if you're dealing with a sick cat, let's suggest, for example, and the cat goes off its food, misses its breakfast, you might take a day or two before you start to realize that maybe this is something that should see the vet. And equally, when you're dealing with a small species with a very high metabolic rate, these animals have to feed. They have no real choice on that matter. And if you become anorexic, then you're pretty much close to death in any sort of level, really, for these sort of species. So owners that use the fact that, oh, well, it's still eating, it can't be too bad, as a judgment or a rationale for not presenting these cases to the clinic sooner, when they do come to see you because the animal's gone, the bird's gone anorexic, then obviously that is a life-threatening critical emergency. So when these birds are coming to see you, I think it's very much worthwhile always to have a very quick look in the cage prior to you taking a history to see what's going on. And certainly with some of these, if they are showing evidence of being critically ill or collapse, or you are worried about the welfare of that patient, then obviously that's the bird you take away and get it straight down into oxygen straight away. And while you've once you've done that, somebody else can get the history, somebody else can confirm the consent for procedures to be done for that individual whilst you're sort of basically rendering emergency aid, as it were. And then I guess there's a question of what we do to that patient once you've got them. And obviously, weight is very important. And the birds really are in a fairly unique situation when it comes to the birds, really, in that in order for birds to fly, you basically have a very set specific species weight range, which basically applies to pretty much all individuals. So when you're looking at a cockatiel, when you're looking at a grey parrot, we know what those species weigh. We know what a fat individual weighs, we know what a normal body condition individual weighs, and we know what a lean individual weighs. So even if you don't have a previous weight record for your cockatiel, for example, if it's seed fed and spends its life sitting in a cage, it's going to be a fat cockatiel, or it used to be a fat cockatiel. For that reason, I'd expect it to probably be 105, 110 grams, for example. If it was an aviary bird actively flying around, maybe that would push it closer to a 100 gram mark, maybe 95. But obviously, you can sort of predict on the basis of the weight and body condition of the bird presented to you whether you feel this has dropped despite not having previous records, or whether this is reasonable for that species in the first instance. So that's quite unique. We can't do that with the mammals. We can't do that with the reptiles, for example. But for the birds, it's always worth having a quick look on the internet and just say, okay, what should my umbrella cockatoo be weighing? And then you've got a very good figure to translate relative to this bird that you're going to be seeing in the clinic. So weight is very useful, and also it's very objective as well. There's no lying on the scales here, such if this bird has lost weight, even though the owner's presenting it as an acute presentation of chronic disease, maybe you can say, okay, this bird is 20 grams less than it should be, and or 20 grams less than it was last time it came in and had its nails trimmed. Therefore, this is a chronic disease process. Therefore, things have been happening, and that's why the bird is much sicker than you think. And that's a very clear message to get across to the owners, it's very easy to relate that to them. So get accurate scales and get them weighed when you see them in consultation. And if they're coming in to stay with you, as a lot of these critical birds will be, because obviously by the sheer nature of the cases we're discussing, they're going to need to, then you want to get a weight first thing in the morning before you do anything to them. And you want to get a weight last thing at night before you give them their final feeds. And what you should get is a progressive weight increase over that day as you're rehydrating and getting nutrition on board. And then basically when it's time for bed, the bird will obviously lose some weight overnight because it's going to be passing feces through. And again, because of the high metabolic rate, the weight will drop back. What you're hoping for when you weigh them the following morning is that should be higher than the weight you had yesterday, and the process continues, as it were, over time. And that's really what we're looking at for these to be doing as a sign for patients doing well in the clinic. Now, obviously, when you're looking at these coming in as critical patients, we've got to work out what's wrong with them, I guess. And depending on that patient, if it's coming straight into oxygen, great, okay, I don't need to look at it at this stage of the game. I can come and assess it in a minute. But in the first instance, I'm just getting it into oxygen and maybe warming it as well, perhaps. However, if you're going to go through and do your physical examination, what you need to do is to make sure what aspects of that clinical examination you're doing is relevant to how you're going to triage or treat that patient. In other words, if it's sick and collapsed, there's no point going through doing every single bit of the examination in detail and taking up a large amount of time while stressing a critically ill patient. I need to get answers to a few pertinent questions at that stage that's going to help me decide how I'm going to manage that case. And maybe we'll come through as we'll see on the next few slides, I'll go through some suggestions really of things that may be quite important to you. So think about why do I need to know, do this bit of the physical exam? How is that going to change how I manage or treat this case? Okay. Detailed look at head, of course, looking at the eyes for swellings, discharges, things like that. Look at the nostrils as well, clear and symmetrical. Look at your beak, see what's going on there. Have a look in the oral cavity, tongue, the mucosa, papillae, the coana, any diptheritic membranes, things like that. Quick look at the ears, maybe. Looking at feathers, obviously, if you've got self-trauma or things going on, or if there's blood present on the bird, you need to find out whether that's coming from a feather quill or whether that's coming from a wound, etc., etc., as well. So really, obviously, a collection of things you need to go through and look at these. And just some examples here for you. Obviously, we have a normal ear here. Squamous cell carcinoma here. We've got large discharge here from the sinus of this grey parrot with upper respiratory signs. Of course, our concern is do you have lower respiratory signs associated with that? Coanal blunting, which you may see. Another nasal discharge here for another bird with respiratory signs. And on here, we're looking at if you've had severe trauma, head trauma, you've got to look at back of eyes as part of your triage, because obviously if vision is impaired, that may be significant. This is oral candida here, stopping a bird from feeding, which needs to be treated. We've got blood loss here from severe scratching and self-trauma. So in some of these cases, as here, we've had to place a neck brace with an extension as an emergency procedure to stop further blood loss and self-trauma. So some of these severe cases, putting a collar on might be part of what you need to do. And again, looking at feathers and damage around here or other areas where they've been chewing is very relevant. And obviously, physical condition is very important as well. Here for your pectoral muscle mass, auscultation is very important as well. Looking at your feet, nail length, things like that can be relevant as well to these. And I suppose other things that are very pertinent for me when you're assessing these is palpation of the coelomic cavity. And realistically, for a lot of these cases where you're seeing sick birds presenting, what we're trying to do is to rule out the presence of a coelomic mass or a coelomic ascites or an egg maybe as a cause for collapse. And certainly, if you're looking at a weakened bird, the presence or absence of an egg makes a big difference in how I'm going to manage that female collapse, female bird. If we've got a marked Salmonicus sites, then that's going to have a very significant bearing on how I'm going to manage and approach a dyspneic bird, for example, versus one that I feel has a primary respiratory problem going on. And again, if you've got area of blood loss or trauma, that's got to be dealt with in the process of your assessment too. Fractures maybe will have a bearing on whether you're going to put bandages on or not, depending on the nature of the bird and how fractious it's going to be. And also looking at the basilic vein can be quite handy as well, because you're then getting a direct idea for the level of, I guess, circulation and blood pressure in that animal just simply by having a look at the refill of that basilic vein. And depending, of course, if you've got areas of significant trauma, for example, like we've got here, I may be needing to collar this bird to stop them getting at it. I may be looking at dressing these, cauterizing wounds. If we've got a Salmonicus sites like the black-headed cake on the picture here, then I'm going to be needing to drain that to ease its breathing whilst I'm thinking of looking at why have you got the ascites in the first place. And obviously, if you've got other ulcerated infective lumps and bumps, then these are things you can deal with but maybe aren't so pressing in the first instance, despite the owner panicking. For example, a blood quill that's lost blood may come in very dramatic, but it probably is going to clot quite quickly. And if all you need to do is to pull that out and put pressure onto the feather quill, you've solved this emergency situation. Birds cope very well with blood loss, much better than a mammal would do, for example. But of course, the chances are this bird is going to end up becoming an inpatient and staying with you. And if that's the case, then you do want to try and get it in the right sort of environment so you can see what's going on. For us, we have dedicated units which are negative pressure ventilated. So basically, this stops cross-contamination on feather dust between patients. So some of these you might be thinking of an infectious disease, PBFD, chlamydia, things like that going on. Keeping them separate in that manner stops transmission, like I say, paying attention to human health risks as well. And ideally, you want to have some remote observation for how these birds are behaving. And there's really two ways you can do that. You're either looking at having a very small window through the door looking into the ward at the patients, where you can just sneak through like a little peek hole almost to see what's going on without the bird actually acknowledging that they're being observed. The other option is to use CCTV or a webcam and have that in place. And that gives you a very good idea of how that bird is genuinely feeling with remote observation. The moment you enter the room and talk to it, it obviously will try its best to feel well or look well. And again, if you're looking at feeding and things, you may not be able to see exactly what it's doing when you're watching it. And certainly, when we're looking at how this bird's behaved, you're coming in the morning, let's suggest, to see what happened overnight, then clearly we want to be in a position that we can monitor the bird's cage and see what's happened. And here we're looking at to see fecal output, urine output, urine coloration, for example, and having a newspaper floor, for example, allows us to do that. And really, then we're quite interested in, say, for example, on this fecal sample we got through here, this bird is polyuric, but we have yellow-green urates being produced as well. And this obviously is pretty much suggestive of a severe hepatopathy being present. Very occasionally, it's hemolysis, but this is bilirubinuria, this is liver disease. And so, being able to critically evaluate these feces is very important as well. And obviously, we want to catch the bird fairly easily. We want to have easy access to food and water. We should be weighing or measuring food and water that's being put in. And certainly, then you want to be evaluating what mess the bird has made on the floor of the cage to try and determine whether you feel this bird has genuinely eaten anything or spread it around or what components of the diet it has taken. If you're dealing with birds of prey, then you do need to have some basic facilities for these so the environment is familiar and more natural for them. So you're going to want to have a bow perch or a block perch for the species that you're dealing with, and you're also going to want to have a tail guard or something to stop the tail feathers from being damaged in the setup that they are in. And to be fair, a lot of the birds of prey are better off, depending on their size, being housed in large dog cages. What we actually utilize for ours is we actually have some walk-in pens, again with just a small little window entry into them, separate lighting for them as well, so they're able to be put onto the relevant perch, tethered to it if necessary. They've got food and water away from where they're standing, so really the risk of them damaging themselves in here and damaging feathers is minimized. And obviously it's quite a controlled environment for them. And the hope is, if you've got them set up in that situation, you're able to directly observe their feeding, directly observe their casting, if they are producing pellets as they should do from ingestion of whole prey items, and that obviously can allow you to determine whether they're suitable for an anaesthetic, for example, if the bird's cast up or how it's doing feeding and being ready to go home. One of the concerns you do have, of course, with some of these critical cases coming through is if they are collapsed, is their ability to actually be able to stand and hold themselves up. And most birds will choose to climb and perch given the choice. The question is whether you feel it's appropriate for your bird to be doing that. And certainly in the cases where they are very collapsed and we just make a horseshoe out of a towel, elevate the front of that bird. The whole point being we don't want to end up getting inadvertent reflux of crop contents that obviously can be fatal, and having them sitting upright and is obviously a very important thing to do. We've already mentioned zoonoses. Main concern here, I guess, is Chlamydophila or Chlamydia infection here. And if we've got birds that we are suspicious of, they should be barrier nursed in addition to having the negative sort of pressure airspace rule applied to them. Main things we see with these is going to be transmission of pathogens through the fecal-oral route or via feather dust. And one of the things that you can do to try and limit the risk of transmission between birds or contamination of your clothes, for example, or the air in which you're working, or in the case of psittacosis, you getting succumbed to zoonotic risks yourself. If you spray and mist all of the paper in the cage before you change it, for example, that will limit the amount of dust and aerosols you're creating. And if you use something like F10, for example, that's diluted down, then obviously you're trying to have some sort of bactericidal or antiviricidal effect as well. So you're limiting aerosol formation and dust formation, but also it's anti disinfectant as well, I guess. So for the psittacosis cases coming through, really you're looking at classical signs coming in. Respiratory would be the main one that we're going to see here. Green urates, as you've already seen. Nasal discharge, ocular discharges, maybe to some dyspnea as well. And so for these, you go straight into barrier nursing. And if you were keen on diagnosing them, then you're looking at doing fecal PCRs or antibody testing, with doxycycline being your treatment of choice for these cases. But of course, if your bird is critically collapsed, then really you've got to get it into a situation where you can stabilize it with minimal handling, minimal diagnostics really, until you've sort of got the bird a bit more stable. And obviously, gentle warming of these birds can be helpful to limit the amount of energy they're expending to maintain their core temperature. So we sort of look at 25 to 30 degrees in the bird units that we use for them. And what these basically have is they've got two heat plates, one on either side, that is warming that environment. They've got a UV across the top for them as well. And we have the capacity for oxygenating here or nebulizing in this setup as well. Clear glass with a rubber seal around so we can see them. And obviously, there's a vent in the top, so we've got air being pulled through the front to limit contamination between patients. And obviously, with these units, you can edit the temperatures if you feel you want to, based on your patient's need. If you don't have these sort of units, then you can use heat lamps, heat pads, hot hands, this sort of type of thing. These obviously allow the bird to move towards and away from them, but the downside is birds tend to have sharp beaks and sharp claws, and they will chew as well. So you do have to be very careful that they can do some self-significant damage from hot hands, for example, by bursting them and chilling them down by the cold water, or chewing through electric cables, this sort of type thing. And if you're going to use a focal heat source, you have to be happy that the creature can move away from that focal heat source. And if they can't, you may risk burning or overheating that individual as well. And of course, some of the sources you're going to be giving, they might need reheating, for example, as well. So if you're going to use like a little snuggle safe, that's great when it's warm. But as soon as it cools down, it's going to act as a chilling, you know, the heat's going to be drawn away from that patient, not being given to the patient. So if you're using things that are going to cool down, you've got to repeatedly put fresh ones back in to keep them warm for the birds as well. So heating, like I say, would benefit most of these patients, particularly if they're collapsed or they're fluffed up, for example. Oxygenation, like I say, is very important as well. You might be doing this via face mask or just putting the oxygen in the general direction of the animal's face. You might get their own cage and make it into an oxygen tent with a towel or cling film, putting oxygen through. Or like I say, in some of these dedicated units, you can actually start putting supplemental oxygen into that environment. And if you've got a meter, you can measure the genuine percentage of oxygen that you're getting, as we've been doing here, for example. So we know with the oxygen supplementation that we're giving for this individual, we have managed to get a 33% of oxygen in the environment. And I think that's quite an important thing. I think a lot of people that are looking at flow by or face mask oxygen, depending on how effective you're being or even making an oxygen tent, the ultimate percentage of oxygen you're giving to that patient might actually be quite much lower than you're thinking because of leakage or mixing with room air, for example. So getting an oxygen meter in there can be quite useful to quantify the effectiveness of your attempt to oxygenation. And like I say, if you're going to give supplemental oxygen, if you've got a bird where you're thinking you've got respiratory problems, there's nothing to stop you attaching that to a nebulizer and using that oxygen flow rate to nebulize a mucolytic or an anti-infective agent or something whilst you're oxygenating that environment as well. The other advantage of that, of course, you're then going to have humidified oxygenated air going in, which will stop desiccation from respiratory mucous membranes as well. And while we're thinking of dehydration of this patient, the question is what do we do next then if we're concerned for that? And birds are very, very good at holding on to their fluid. So as much as they have a high metabolic rate, their fluid requirements per day are 50 mils per kilo per day. So it matches what you'd expect for a dog, for example, because they're so good at retaining that. If they're ill or diseased, then it may be increased, of course. And if you've got a sick bird, you might sort of basically assume that it's 10% dehydrated, probably is acidotic as well. And you might get sunken eyes, skin tenting, body weight, of course. The basilic vein reefer may give you all a guide for how dehydrated you think this bird is likely to be. And much as you can go through and calculate it, in many cases you may be looking more at coming up with a need for something more practical than that. So, yes, okay, you can calculate the deficit. Or if you've got a sick bird and you're making the assumptions that it's dehydrated already, you could just say, let's go for straight doubling fluid therapy straight away. So we're going to give it 100 mils per kilo per day and just do that. Monitor the weight for that bird and obviously look at urine and fecal output, because as you're pushing fluids through, either parenterally or orally, you'd expect to see urine production and obviously fecal output too. Now, for the birds, they don't really tolerate giving sets, so you're going to be giving boluses parenterally or orally as your main way of doing that. And that then makes you have to have a little bit of a slightly different look to how you're going to get fluids into this bird. And practically, we tend to have maximum amount of fluids that we give to a bird is 10 mils per kilo in one sitting. So if we were giving fluid therapy parenterally, that's the sort of volume that we're looking at. And if the bird is able to tolerate oral fluids, then we're probably looking at going 1% of body weight orally as well. The crop volume will hold more than that, but 1% is about right. for these sort of cases we're considering. And if you do that at the same time as your parenteral fluids, then really we're going to be giving 20 mils per kilo of fluid therapy at that time point. And if we're looking at giving 100 mils per kilo over the day, you're basically then saying, okay, if I do this 5 times, I'm getting twice maintenance. And practically, if you're sitting back and looking at a case of how you're going to achieve this, then generally over the course of a normal working day, you probably get 5 times of supportive care into that bird, which then means you're not panicking so much about doing it overnight. You've just done a 9 o'clock, a 12 o'clock, a 2 o'clock, a 4 o'clock, and a before you leave at the end of the day, as it were, and you've kind of got the supportive care in terms of the hydration status at least sorted for that patient. Now, depending, of course, where the birds come from and the situation, you might find you get some spontaneous drinking, and that's obviously great, and you've got to give them the opportunity to do that. So asking the owner of this bird whether it's used to drinking from a water fountain on the side of the cage, for example, or whether it's used to drinking from a bowl on the floor of the cage is critically important to allow you to treat it accordingly and offer water source for it. And if we're talking about methods of now us, I guess, taking over and giving this bird fluid therapy spontaneously, then really you've got the oral route, subcutaneous, intraosseous or intravenous, and you can use obviously a combination of these depending on the patient that you're dealing with. Now, oral fluids are great. Most of them will tolerate it quite fine. It's easy. Some owners might do this at home. They might be able to crop chew the birds themselves. And obviously, you can get water into them. You can push electrolytes at them. And obviously, you can start using liquid food. So, we've already mentioned the metabolic rate of some of these patients. And maybe I need to get a very simple carbohydrate source in fairly quickly into these birds as well. And we'll come on to supportive nutrition next. And obviously, you can replace losses relatively easy this way. And you're best off using a solid crop needle for these. For the parrots, it makes life easy because they will chew through rubber catheters, for example. And if you're going to use a rubber catheter, then you're going to have to have a mouth gag for your parrot, and that's just an extra bit of instrumentation that you don't need. And if you are concerned you're going to lose your crop tube, then you either have to hold it with the end of your fingers below the fitment, so you want to sort of hold it here. Alternatively, if you go for a lure fitting syringe, then this isn't going to fall off into the crop of that bird. And occasionally that does happen, and you get a member of staff get all excited because they've suddenly lost a crop tube inside the bird. Your trick, if that ever happens to you, is you must basically get to the bird as soon as you can, palpate the crop, and pinch the crop tube with two of your fingers to hold it in place in the crop. Having done that, you've then just basically got to gradually feed that crop tube back out of the mouth before it sort of tries to pass down any further. You will get some reflux with that, and you just have to be aware of that, and then basically pop the bird back and let it sort of cough and splutter and clear its own throat, as it were, before you start doing it again, and then maybe get that staff member a little more supervised or with a lure fitting syringe to prevent the occurrence again. I guess once it's happened to you once, it doesn't very often happen to you again. You've learnt the lesson, as it were. So for these, we hold them in the towel. Birds of prey, you can put your finger in the mouth as a gag if you want to do that, and basically use your other hand to advance the crop tube down into the crop of the bird. These come obviously in a variety of sizes, and normally you'd be advancing down the left side of the mouth, which is, I suppose, a more natural way that a right-handed person would do this. For a left-handed person, maybe I'm going down the other side of the mouth in to do this, and on a number of texts they tell you which side is more the relevant side to do. It makes no difference whatsoever. You handle this bird and crop tube it what is the most comfortable way for you to do it. And realistically, you'll probably be doing this single-handed, although once you start getting to some of the bigger macaws, you may switch to having a second person helping you restraining the bird. But on the main, you'll be doing this yourself. And basically, your aim is to go over the base of the tongue, down the side of the glottis and into the esophagus, into the crop. Some of these you can go into the proventriculus, and we do proventricular feeding where we get the chance. For these, if you're going to go into the proventriculus, you need to come down, palpate your crop tube in the crop, and then you're gradually rotating your crop tube until it falls through the thoracic inlet down into the proventriculus. And no force is required here. Gravity will do the job for you. And once it's obviously fallen down in deeper, you can then instill your 1% of body weight into, like I said, the crop or the proventriculus. But this has to be the last thing that you do. And inexperienced people, there is an increased tendency to accidentally compress the crop, and that obviously can lead to reflux and regurgitation, which can be a problem. And in a lot of cases, do this last. Do all your other injectable parenteral treatments you want to do first. Weigh the bird, everything you want to be done, and then you give them a crop feed, and it's straight back into their cage again, and you leave them unhandled, basically. The more you handle, the more they struggle, the more risk you've got of compressing the crop and causing a reflux. And so it's important to do this last. Like I say, depending on what crop volume you want to give, we tend to stick for 1%. It seems to be the practical way for a lot of them. Critically ill birds like this kestrel, maybe you're down at 0.5%. And for those, maybe you want to give more frequent administration of food and electrolytes orally. There's no point, if you've got a bird with a crop stasis or a crop blockage, of putting more food into that crop. The crop is just simply a storage organ, not for digestion. And if you want to get energy and things into the bird quickly, then you've got to feed it down into the proventriculus and bypass the crop until the crop is turning over or emptying and being more functional and effective. And if you are concerned that your crop is in stasis, then a lot of people will use things like metoclopramide to stimulate crop turnover. Now, when you're looking at these, obviously there is a risk of accidental intubation. And if we just have a quick look at the next picture here, the glottis, depending on your bird species, can be fairly easy to see. So in a swan, very, very clearly evident. Kookaburra here, again, very clearly evident. Clearly evident in the Harris hawk. Without pulling this tongue forward and looking just behind that, that you're really going to struggle with a cockatiel. What we can say, if you're using birds, maybe I'd say less than 100 grams, if you're using a sensible sized crop tube, it is very, very, very difficult to accidentally intubate a bird of less than 100 grams with a crop tube. So with those, you're fairly safe. Once you get beyond the 100 grams, and it is possible to intubate it with your crop tube, but again, because you've reached beyond the 100 grams, you normally can have quite a nice view of your glottis anyway. And in all of these cases, irrespective of whether you've seen it or not, you want to be able to palpate the trachea and your feeding tube separate in this bird's crop prior to administering food. So again, parrot here being held using a rigid tube, and in a bird of prey here, we've got a finger in the jaw, and you can see quite nice that's being passed down the side of the glottis there. We've already mentioned why we might be considering using preventricular fluids in these birds, and if they've got a risk of regurgitation from being very collapsed, for example, we've got a crop stasis and it's not being turned over effectively. But of course, we might have direct trauma or damage to that crop as well. So a crop rupture, for example, which is the lower picture here of a wood pigeon that basically had a full crop, then flew into a window. And obviously that can cause a change in pressure and lead to rupture of that organ. Or you may have a crop burn for people that are hand feeding birds, for example, microwaving or rearing food, and then obviously getting hot spots within that which they haven't realized, that then is causing thermal damage and necrosis of local tissue. And like I say, to get into the proventriculus, you should just gradually twist this tube round until it falls into place. And for this reason, we like using the slightly bent metal tubes as opposed to the rigid straight ones, because it's easier to manipulate it down in. And obviously, once you're happy that it's gone down nicely through into proventriculus, you can deliver the fluids. And this is just using a straight crop tube here on this radiograph, but just basically showing you how far in that's going to be going down into the bird. And with the bent tubes, what you've got is your tube is coming down and bending at this angle here. And if you rotate it around a 360 angle, at some point it will find the thoracic inlet and just fall in further with no physical force required. Now, if you the oral route is not an option, then subcutaneous is really your next plan. And there's probably two sites that we would do this, and I'm really just going to tell you the one which I think is most pertinent to you, which is the inguinal skin fold. And this is basically the skin between the leg and the body cavity. And bear in mind, of course, the body cavity at this point has air sacs, so please, you've got to be careful of your exact site. Now, this particular citizen here has lovingly feather plucked the site for us, so we can see the skin fold quite nicely where we wish to inject. And this is again a Harris hawk now having the fluids injected at that same site. And we'll sort of use 1% of body weight. Some cases we'll split it between two legs. Sometimes we give 1% one leg at its go, really depending on the case. And if you're concerned about volume or this causing discomfort to the bird, then we do actually spend a lot of our time adding hyaluronidase to this, which works quite nice. This basically lowers the viscosity of hyaluronic acid, increases the tissue permeability, and it spreads over a much larger area. So that collapsed and debilitated bird, maybe you're able to give it some fluids with hyaluronidase into its inguinal fold before you pop it into heat and pop it into oxygen and let that fluid absorb while you're finishing getting details from the consult, for example. And obviously, if you're anaesthetizing these birds for a variety of reasons, then this is a chance you have to give them some extra fluid therapy as well. Your next sort of upgrade from your subcutaneous is intraosseous. You must not use pneumatized bone. So basically, the femur and humerus is avoided. Tibia tarsus or ulna can be used. I'd argue tibia tarsus is easier for a lot of people because they're used to or potentially learning one singular technique that you can use then in a gerbil, for example, or you could use in a bearded dragon as well as using it in your birds. But they do tend to be more poorly tolerated and more uncomfortable for the birds. So perianesthesia, they work very well, but for a sick patient, maybe less so. For these, then you're down to using the distal or proximal ulna. And for these, you can go for a straight hypodermic needle, which will work fine for you. But in a lot of cases, if we can, we prefer to use the an intraosseous needle with a stylet. And this stops a bone plug from forming, so you can get a much clearer sample. And this is just a tibia tarsal sample here, but obviously we're aspirating here just to prove the point, really. But obviously, you know, under GA, this has got a nice site for getting fluids and medications into this patient. And certainly if they were to go through a crash situation and you were concerned, then this is something you can place very, very quickly in a moribund bird. Under GA, if you're doing more major surgery, for example, so if here, for example, we've been removing a neck tumour, then in that circumstance, your IO can go in quite happily and be out of your way, really. Obviously, we've also got here your Doppler here for monitoring that patient as well. For intravenous fluid therapy, then really you've got to be either very collapsed or a tolerant species, I guess, and we can sort of, your tolerant species are going to be maybe some of your pigeons, waterfowl, occasionally a bird of prey, things like that. Or you're going to be collapsed and couldn't care less, or maybe you're also going to have an anaesthetic to do that. And obviously it's up to you to balance the needs of your patient and how you're going to get fluids in relative to what you wish to do for that patient. And you've really got three intravenous sites available for you for these species. You have got your basilic vein, and we said this is very useful for looking for rehydration status here under the wing. Can be quite difficult to place conscious, And certainly in a moribund bird, we've actually been quite lucky, even in some of the greys that have been just that collapsed, we've just placed one conscious. And to avoid suturing in place, we've actually superglued as we were desperate enough, and ironically, they have left that alone. Jugular veins are normally tolerated better in the citizenes, and obviously you've got the medium metatarsal here being used to induce a swan here as it happens, but these are very easy to catheterize in your bigger waterfowl to be used. Jugular catheter placement, again, just showing you here in a grey parrot that's under anaesthesia here, but again, very common sight to use. And normally, like I say, for the basilic vein catheters, we would be suturing at two points to the skin here and here with our wing, and then at this point we're going to put a loop of suture material around the main sort of secondary feathers here. In order to stop this from kinking at a 90 degree angle, the feather shafts will hold this at the right angle for continued IV fluid therapy for that bird. And like I say, worst case scenario, we've come in and we've just glued this in place because we didn't want to be trying to suture the bird conscious. And again, what do I give? How do I do that? We already mentioned you can either make the assumption it's dehydrated or try and calculate it, then work out how you're going to replace this deficit, how much on the first day, how much on the next 2 days. Or for ease, I just go for twice maintenance for these birds until we start getting urination and feces being fast passed. And once that's happening, I know I've got them nicely hydrated. I can tell by the weight gain that I've gone from a 90 gram cockatiel to a 100 gram cockatiel, for example. And I know that I've got a rehydrated bird with a full GI tract now. Hartmann's is perfectly fine and suitable for all of the cases that we deal with, to be honest. I wouldn't be worrying about anything else. And like I say, don't forget your hyaluronidase here to speed up absorption of sub-Q fluids, but only sub-Q. We also use tomitipion things as well. This is quite useful. This is an infant bottle warmer, but these are quite handy because they can raise that temperature of fluids for that individual. And obviously what we don't want to be doing is be giving cold fluids to a bird and causing it more debility. So getting them warm is quite critical in the first instance as well, and this can be quite helpful while you're stabilizing their circulation. Small birds can obviously have very high metabolic rate. As we said, we're concerned about them feeding, so we need to get them fed as soon as we can do. And like I say, if they're waiting until this bird is anorexic, then clearly this is in quite an extreme state. So weight monitoring is useful because that will give you a guide as to how much assist feeding each individual needs, and you may alter what you're giving dependent on how you feel that bird's weight is doing and responding to your treatment that you are giving. In addition to that, you have to bear in mind that it can take you some time, and reducing that time if the bird's doing it spontaneously is great. And obviously the temperature of that bird has a massive impact, and a lot of birds of prey, for example, where they're being housed outside, if there's a sudden temperature drop overnight, that can have a significant impact on their perceived food requirements. And some owners will get caught out with that and suddenly realise they need to be giving more than they thought. And equally, from your point of view, if you're waiting to see if a patient is going to respond to therapy, starting to gradually wean back its supportive nutrition whilst monitoring its weight will give you a very good idea as to whether you need to be stepping up your game or whether the bird is adequately doing things itself now. We want to give the bird free access to them, food that they like, giving it to them in a familiar fashion, and ideally leave them with the same diet. If you stop playing around and changing this diet, even if it's for the better, the last thing you want to do is to make this bird anorexic because you've changed the diet. And again, if they're not feeding, then it's assist feeding needed, and your crop tube, preventricular tube, is important to go through, and exactly really as we said before for the fluid therapy. So we do have to be aware, of course, that if they've been anorexic or they've escaped and been recaptured, or they're a wildlife casualty that's become sick enough to be caught, then you may have a slowdown of your GI motility. And this could be birds of prey primarily, but we just see it in other species too. And obviously, if you've got food sitting in a crop that's kept at body temperature but isn't being digested, then you'll get a sauerkraut in these cases. And certainly you'll see that in birds of prey quite commonly. If they've had a bird escape for 48 hours, hasn't eaten, bird comes back, it's enthusiastic for food because it's desperate. You give it a load of food, it overfills, over-distends its crop, at which point the food just sits there and then it becomes septic. And that then adds and compounds your problem for that bird. So for these, if you're seeing this bird coming in that's catabolic, that hasn't been feeding, get it something in that's high energy, but it needs to be easily digestible and liquid, and in some cases straight down into the proventriculus in preference to the crop. If your crop is distended with food and is not being turned over, then you may need to evacuate that under anaesthesia. You can try it conscious, but again, the risk of aspiration for these is very high as you're trying to expel crop contents. So the rule of thumb really is for any of these cases coming through, I start with electrolytes or maybe going for the Vetart critical care for some basic carbohydrates going through to instill some energy on board first. And what I'm looking for here is that crop to turn over. What I'm looking for is feces to be passed. And if feces are being passed, I know I've restored gut motility. Having done that, for the carnivorous species, we can then look at using Oxbow Carnivore Care or Hill's AD or something. Again, very liquid, but again, I'm starting to push more calories through now. And obviously, a higher protein source, which I'm happy to because, of course, I've rehydrated them successfully first, that I know I'm not going to have a damaging effect on kidneys by switching to that source for those species. And if the crop is continuing to turn over, we're getting things coming through, you could start then feeding them real food, as it were, prey items without castings. And as I said, you might want to add metoclopramide into the situation here. And then obviously you can start adding some castings in, maybe whole prey coming in over the next sort of couple of days to see if this bird isn't able to cast successfully. And it probably takes 48 hours to do that. If you're dealing with other birds, similar sort of principle, start with your critical care, maybe for the first couple of feeds, make sure the crop's turning over, make sure fecal samples are being produced, and then maybe switching on to the Emerade Omnivore perhaps is our now preferred choice for these, really, following on from that Vetart diet. But of course, there's others out there. If you want to go through the Oxbow range again, you're welcome to do so. But we tend to be sticking with the Emerade now because it's easier and maybe a bit more energy dense than you're going to get from the Oxbow for these cases. Although for the big waterfowl, for example, then we may be using more herbivorous style diets with a higher fiber content, of course. And it is important for these birds when you're looking at supportive nutrition to actually have access to some standard diets, and it may be the owner brings it in, it may be it doesn't, but obviously we want to try and keep it the same. And if they're used to taking seeds, you feed them seeds. If they're used to taking a pelleted diet, you want to try and match that pelleted diet as well. The final sort of thing for these cases coming through as well will be, of course, analgesia. We use a lot of butorphanol where we feel they've had significant trauma. Obviously, it's fairly short-acting, lasting for a couple of hours, and we're using it because of the kappa receptors. And if you're concerned your bird is in discomfort, then obviously let's suggest it's a fracture. If you're looking at having to capture that bird 6 or 12 times a day to effectively give it analgesia, I'd argue that's of a concern if you've got an unstable fracture. And that does obviously limit your usefulness for butorphanol, extensively around the sort of surgery or anesthesia period. Perisurgically, I get it, but obviously it is quite difficult. Tramadol is an alternative, which we do use orally at home, but obviously you do have tramadol injection as well, and that might be another alternative for you to consider should you feel that opioids are needed. Non-steroidals, of course, we do use routinely for these as well. Once we're happy that they're nicely hydrated, once we're happy that we don't have sort of gout involved in them, then meloxicam is the one that we would be choosing. We do have a couple of questions the end of today's webinar to catch up with. First one of these is obviously getting a diagnosis in these cases beyond your clinical impression. And certainly we do blood sample a number of these birds conscious, depending on the case, and some are tolerant of that. And certainly at the very least for these, going through and looking at things like uric acid levels, PCV, white cell count, proteins, ionized calcium level and electrolytes are things that most people can do in-house quite routinely, even if you don't have access to bile acids or are unable to do a detailed hematology. What you're interested in here is things that are going to influence your care of that bird. If this bird is coming in with gout, I need to know. I may need to euthanize it, but obviously my fluid therapy may need to be changed. If I'm losing protein, I may need to work out where. If I'm hypercalcemic, clearly I'm going to need to start getting some calcium on board. So sometimes running a little bit of an in-house profile can help you guide a little bit of what's going on, which may be a bit more sensible there for you. And the next thing on the list maybe is radiography or imaging. I guess we're quite lucky now that we can CT a lot of our patients, and we're very lucky that a lot of our collapsed parrots we can CT instantly without an anaesthetic, and that works very, very well. In the absence of CT, if you're looking at radiography, then obviously if you're unable to anaesthetize that patient, you've got to think of a way of how I can practically get an x-ray. And I guess for a lot of these, what we're looking for on these sort of things is, for me, I guess signs of a foreign body is quite relevant, or maybe a GI blockage perhaps. And for some of these, you'll be able to get that using a horizontal beam view of these birds looking for just radiodense material. And that might give you a bit of a feel for ruling out some things with a conscious x-ray whilst you're stabilizing, and then the following day maybe an anaesthetic and getting some orthogonal views is more appropriate for you the following day. But those I would suggest is probably the first sort of things to consider diagnostically. Maybe you can look at some fecal samples and crop washes. By all means, do that. If you're going to be crop chipping this bird and it's producing feces, why not? But obviously, you're trying to get this bird to the point that you actively can anaesthetize and get a diagnosis if you don't have something obvious from your initial presentation history taking. That is the end of the webinar. I'm going to pass you now back to Sammy. Thank you very much for attending.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.